KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
We're very, very concerned that our kids of color are being suspended at higher rates than other kids, and it's an issue that we want to proactively address.
If you double NASA's budget, that would be enough to go to Mars soon with people and go to, back to the moon and on to asteroids.
We have to make sure system-wide that when our men and women get an invisible wound of the war, they are treated, they're treated effectively, and they're not told it's just in your head, and they are especially not told that we're not going to treat you because it costs too much.
Our Senator Patty Murray talking last year about PTSD and diagnoses at Madigan Army Medical Center. Before that, astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson talking about why we should fund NASA. And we started off with Bernardo Ruiz, Director of Equity and Race Relations for Seattle Public Schools. From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. I'm in for Steve Scher this week. The U.S. Department of Education is investigating Seattle schools. And at issue, they want to find out whether black students in the district are disciplined more harshly and more frequently than white students in the schools. KUOW's education reporter Ann Dornfeld broke this story yesterday, and she joins us from an undisclosed location someplace. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Marcy.
Thanks for being with us. I'm curious how you first got onto this story.
Yeah, a source told me last week that the district had been contacted about the federal investigation, and so I contacted the Department of Education, and in an email, the agency spokesman told me that the Office for Civil Rights within the Department of Ed is looking into whether black students in Seattle are disciplined unfairly, specifically more frequently and harshly than white students for the same infractions.
So what can you explain a little bit more about what that means?
Right. Over the past decade, the percentage of elementary school students, for instance, in Seattle, who got at least one short-term suspension a year, has really held steady for white students. But that number has tripled for black students. And another stat from the district website is that more than a quarter of black middle schoolers were suspended last year. It's hard to tease out how much of that is an issue of poverty versus race, because poor kids tend to get in trouble more often than wealthier kids. And black students and students of color in general in Seattle are more often low income. So that's something that the feds are going to be looking at.
I don't know whether you know how the feds found out about this. Is this something that they were tipped to?
They say that they weren't tipped to it by complaints, but rather the district is required to submit its discipline statistics to the feds every year. So they have the information ahead of them. And the Obama administration has made disproportionate discipline a priority for the Office for Civil Rights. And so they've been looking at it in other cities. Seattle is just the latest. And since the feds have already determined the correlation that all of us can see, they're now trying to determine causation. So they're asking the district for detailed school-by-school information about who's getting in trouble and how they're punished. So they can fairly compare how the same administrator is treating the same offense when it's committed by kids of different skin color.
When did they start this study?
Well, the investigation apparently began last May, but a lot of folks in the district just heard about it yesterday, surprisingly. So it's not really clear how long the district has been cooperating, but the district says they've been cooperating the entire time.
And I know that you spoke with Bernardo Ruiz, who's the director of equity and race relations for the public school district. What specifically is the district response to questions about this investigation?
Well, the district is definitely copping to the fact that there is a disproportionality. I mean, that's hard to argue. He says that there are a lot of problems that go into this. One of them, he thinks, is that teachers aren't necessarily in tune with their students, and maybe disciplining kids for things that aren't actually offenses. So I spoke to Native American families, for instance, who said that their teachers are upset that their students aren't giving them eye contact, but in in many cultures, giving an elder eye contact is a sign of disrespect, not respect. So he said that they're looking at ways to help bridge those cultural gaps between teachers and students. He also said that they've formed several task forces and advisory committees to look at this already. I know the district had a series of public meetings addressing this earlier this fall. So it's been an ongoing issue, and the district's really been looking at this for decades. I mean, in the 1980s, the superintendent at that point put down a moratorium on suspensions and expulsions for elementary schoolers. But then the pendulum has swung back and forth several times since, and right now we have, in many districts around the state, a zero tolerance policy. So if a kid messes up once, boom, they're out of school.
Hmm. We're talking with KUOW education reporter Ann Dornfeld. She broke a story yesterday that the U.S. Department of Education was investigating Seattle public schools to find out whether Black students are disciplined more harshly and more frequently than white students. The answer definitely was that the statistics show that they were. The question is why. You mentioned some families, at least that Native American families, are aware of discrepancies. What about teachers? What do they say?
Well, I think teachers that I've spoken to definitely have no desire to kick kids out of school in most cases, but they're kind of trapped between a rock and a hard place because as budgets have decreased over the years, some of the more moderate discipline tactics like in-house suspension have not been available because they don't have the staffing to monitor and teach kids in separate classrooms. So really the option is either keep the kid in their original class or get them out of school is what the teachers feel like. So they're concerned that that if this is an unfunded, you know, mandate, that what will end up happening is they'll be keeping more disruptive kids in the classroom and harming the learning environment for all kids. So I think that they are wary of what some of these fixes may be if they are not really supported and funded by the district.
Conversely, if you want to remove a child who's disruptive from a class, a lot of parents I've read about argue that you're sentencing them to the non-academic path in life. You're going right from the public schools into the penal system because you're blocking off access to education.
Right, and that is a big concern, and that's something that some bills in the state legislature are looking at right now, which is the fact that most districts don't provide kids with any homework or academic support when they're suspended or expelled. And it's considered sometimes like part of the punishment, which is kind of perverse. But that's something Seattle says that they do actually provide kids who are suspended with homework. But of course, you know, a kid sitting at home with homework isn't necessarily supported
right.
academically.
So it's
that's a big concern.
It sounds like, on the one hand, once we have verification of numbers and instances of punishment and how it correlates between different races, that's one finding. But as it always comes down to with education, it's about having financial resources to do something constructive once you have that information.
Right, right. You know, it always comes down to money, especially these days. But I think that there are some perhaps not as expensive tactics that the district is considering. One of them is called restorative justice. And this is, you know, you might sound like more of a touchy-feely approach to discipline, but it's where if the kid, you know, mouths off to the teacher instead of saying, you know, you're out of the classroom for 4 days, the teacher or administrator might sit down and really just kind of talk to the kid and find out what's going on and, you know, why they lashed out. And then the kid is required to really think about that and talk to the class about it and kind of bounce ideas off their peers. So sounds like what you might see more at an alternative school. But Seattle is considering putting programs like that in place to try to I guess, work with kids rather than just get rid of them.
Ann Dornfeld is KUOW's education reporter, and yesterday she broke the story that the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights is investigating Seattle Public Schools for unfair punishment or un, unequal. I don't even know. It's just a whole huge mess of whether black kids get punished more frequently and more harshly than white students in the district. Anne, thank you so much for the time.
My pleasure.
And now it's time for Voices of Cole. All this week, EarthFix, our environmental news partners, are bringing us audio postcards of people who have personal stakes in the Northwest's proposals to build coal export terminals.
My name is Slay Elkton, which comes from right here where we stand. My second name is Watatlam, which comes from the islands. My Christian name is Jeremiah Julius, or J. Julius is what I go by. I'm a member of the Lummi Nation, and I'm a council member of the Lummi Nation. We are standing at Cherry Point, which is the proposed site for the largest coal port in North America. It is a 3,500-year-old village of the Lummi Nation people, Salish people. We harvest all through here, just off the beach and all the way out from halibut. Salmon run through here. And crab, prawns, and shellfish. And right outside of you, right here to your left, 75 yards into the water, is a documented reef net site where, going back 3,500 years, we harvested in the traditional reef netting way, which is unique to us. We invented it. And the dock is proposed to go right over the top of it. Fishing is our culture. To us, culture is fish. So it could be and will be very detrimental if coal goes through, the coal port. It's all about money. And I believe this is one nation under God, but I think it's, if things like this continue to go through, it's not. It's one nation under money, and it's really tragic.
That's Lummi tribal leader Jay Julius. He opposes the proposed coal terminals. What do you think? You can email us at weekday@kuow.org and find a link to our entire series, Voices of Coal, at our website. It's kuow.org.
It's 9:17. We're going to contemplate the future of America's space program with the Internet's favorite astrophysicist, Neil deGrasse Tyson, in a minute, right here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from City University of Seattle, a private, not-for-profit university where students can earn a master's or bachelor's degree in teaching, business, counseling, or information technology. More information at cityu.edu.
45 degrees in Seattle, mostly cloudy. Forecast says expect showers today with a high of 48. It's 9:18. We're going to listen in on a pond full of singing frogs in 25 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman in for Steve Scher this week. What is it about space that we Earthlings find endlessly fascinating? Even when detritus plummets out of the sky, we get excited. You can witness the reaction to the meteor crash into the Russian city of Chelyabinsk last month. What will we do if something like that happened here in Seattle?
If a meteor was going to hit Earth tomorrow, what would you do today?
Oh, I'm going to party like it's 1999.
Tell my boyfriend I apologize and I love him because I told him to kill himself today.
Well, first, I would go to a bank and withdraw all my money, maybe some other people's money as well.
Whatever the heck I wanted to do, I don't know.
I would pray.
I would leave work.
I'd be done working.
Build a spaceship and leave.
So wait, Ross, what are you constructing your spaceship out of?
Mostly tin cans and gasoline, so probably some cardboard. You gotta put the gasoline in something.
I'd go on the top of the Space Needle, and I would greet her with a smiling face, and I would die a happy man.
Sort of voices collected by our high school radio program, Radioactive. When you're a kid, you look up at the stars and you try to locate the bright ones that you think are planets, and you think about the vastness of the universe, and then you go on to something else. Well, Neil deGrasse Tyson was one of those kids who took musing about space into his career as an astrophysicist. Neil deGrasse Tyson is the director of the Hayden Planetarium and research associate in the Department of Astrophysics at the American Museum of Natural History. He's been a radio and television host. He's an author, a federal advisor to the NASA program, and he is the link between we mere mortals and the world of outer space. Neil deGrasse Tyson's latest book out in paperback is Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier, and he joins us. Hello. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Is it snowing where you are?
It's just beginning. It was supposed to get 5 to 8 inches in the area. So, yeah. And airports are starting to close down. You know, what happened to the day when you'd close after the snow landed? Well, they're preemptively canceling planes, you know.
Well, it won't last long. It's March. So we can go from that white stuff on the ground to the stuff we see in the sky. I want to take you back to last month's meteor, because I know you were asked about it endlessly. But it got me to wondering, I got confused as to the difference between meteors and asteroids, because there was some worry at the same time about asteroids that were coming, or an asteroid that was coming close to the planet. Are they the same thing?
Sure, we can tighten up that vocabulary. First, we have too many words for this first phenomenon, so I apologize in advance. Oh, by the way, before I tell you what that sequence of words is, the interviews, was it on Radioactive? Is that
the, yes, that's the
yeah. What intrigued me is not one of the students said when asked what they would do. Not one of them said, I would find a way to deflect it.
Aha. Uh-huh. But we should be doing that. That's a whole other...
Well, that's right. And if you're an engineer or a scientist, that's your first thought. Okay. Your first thought is not, oh, let me apologize to my friend.
To my friend that I insulted. Right. Okay. So you're thinking about the big shield that we're going to put up.
I just want to put that up front. And that when you're in a, when you have a community, when you have a nation of innovators, and that is your culture, then you don't run away from problems such as that. You actually solve them. Hmm. And so I just had to get that out there.
Okay. So what we're talking, in the case of Chelyabinsk, that it weighed tons, the meteor.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So here's how it goes. So you have asteroids that roam freely through interplanetary space. And there's tens of thousands of them that we have cataloged so far whose orbits cross the orbit of the Earth. So those are asteroids, and they're of any size. And, well, not any size, but they're asteroid size.
Yeah, okay.
They're little ones, they're big ones. And then when it penetrates Earth's atmosphere and is rendered a glow, it's called a meteor.
So it's the same stuff.
It's the same. And then if any of it survives the journey and you can pick it up on the ground, it's a meteorite.
Uh-huh.
So there you have it.
Okay. Now I get the thing. So the meteor that crashed into Chelyabinsk was one of the larger particles that are...
Okay. So the way a typical shooting star at night,
yeah,
that's a meteor. And those are no bigger than the size of a blueberry. But yet they're rendered quite visible because of how high energy they have as they plunge through Earth's atmosphere.
Wow.
So those are tiny. Occasionally you get a bigger one that has a beautiful explosion at the end. We call those bolides.
Uh-huh.
And once again, they're harmless. This happens way up high in the atmosphere. And those are about the size of, I guess, a golf ball, something like that. The one that exploded over Chelyabinsk is about 15 meters across, which is also small. It's not as small as what I just listed, but it's too small for us to have any hope of detecting it before it's too late.
I was just going to ask you that. Don't we see these things? Do we have technology that allows us to know what's penetrating our atmosphere and plummeting towards us?
We see the big... Well, then it's too late, so who cares if you saw it? Yes,
okay.
I detected it.
Well, you could move out of the way.
So could we ever detect one of these early enough to evacuate a city? And the answer is no.
Wow.
No. And there are bigger ones. So the one that gave us a buzz cut later that day,
mm-hmm.
That was a big day for asteroids, right? And astronomers were everyone's best friend that day.
Otherwise, we'd just ignore you.
We didn't teach any classes that day. Everybody was out there helping the media. So that one is about half the size of a football field. And that, it turns out, was not discovered by NASA. That was discovered by someone who got a grant from the Planetary Society, an amateur astronomer in Spain, who had discovered that. And that's below many thresholds that NASA has prioritized for cataloging asteroids. The threshold is about 100 meters is what they're bucking for right now. If you catalog every 100-meter asteroid that crosses Earth's orbit, then you have a handle on any asteroid that could possibly disrupt civilization.
Huh.
That's how energetic those would be. The one over Chelyabinsk, that was just a bad day for the residents there, but it didn't kill anybody. It shattered some glass, of course, but that's about it.
It looked really cool. I understand that Russians have electronics on their car dashboards, and that's why we got to see so many images of it.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
I'm thinking, I want one.
Well, I just thought, as far as I could understand from things I read and things I listened to, as you mentioned, it's a bad day for Chelyabinsk, but these things are penetrating our atmosphere all the time, right?
Yeah, so Earth plows through anywhere between 1 and 300 tons of meteors per day. And most of that comes down harmlessly in the form of shooting stars or falling stars. Either is equally good. And occasionally you get a big one, and this was a big one. By the way, this had 25 times the explosive energy of the A-bomb that exploded over Hiroshima.
Wow.
So you can ask, well, why didn't anyone survive this one? Because it exploded about 20 miles up, much higher in the atmosphere. And so that explosive energy dilutes as it comes down, and leaving only a shockwave strong enough to shatter glass. Many people who got injured by the glass, that happened because the first thing that happens is the flash. And that reaches you at the speed of light. Huh. And it's many manifold times brighter than the sun. So anyone who had any sight line to the window would wonder what had just happened. So then they walk to the window, and then the shock wave follows, which only can move at the speed of sound. And that's so you get a lot of people with facial glass injuries to their face for that reason.
We're talking with astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. Right now we're talking about, they're all one thing. The asteroid that enters our atmosphere becomes the meteor, and it becomes a meteorite once there's stuff left over.
Excellent. That's asteroids 101. You just passed.
Did I do it? Thanks. Yay. One of our listeners said, what about something called a meteoroid? What's that?
Oh, I didn't want to have to go there, but you know, make me do it. All right. So the little bitty ones that are blueberry size, pea size.
Yeah, yeah.
Those, no one wants to call those an asteroid in space because they're just, who would do that? So we invented this other word for these itty bitty asteroids the size of peas that are responsible for all these meteors, for the most shooting stars at night, and we call those meteoroids.
So you mentioned when I started, after we ran the little montage of voices that our high school students collected, that nobody talked about making a shield to deflect this. Is there such a thing? Is it even possible?
Oh, yeah. So, a shield would deflector shield would prevent it from hitting us by bouncing off or something. That concept is familiar in futuristic science fiction stories. But that's not, we don't know how to make a deflector shield in that sense. But we do know, at least on paper, how to deflect it out of its current orbit.
Hmm.
And you don't have to deflect it much if you get it early enough. And you slide it just a little bit to the side, and that little bit accumulates given enough time so that it can entirely miss the Earth rather than hit. And we know how to do that. We'd have the engineering figured out. We have the physics of it figured out. But there is no funded project to accomplish this anywhere in the world.
I'm going to switch from meteors to more generally the study of the universe. I introduced you by saying that we all, or most of us, have spent time, especially when we were young, sort of wondering how far those stars go and contemplating what infinity is. What is it about the universe that hooked you at such a young age?
Well, I think it can hook anybody. I don't think I was special in this regard. I bet everyone remembers their first trip to their local planetarium.
Sure.
When the stars go out and the lights turn out and the stars come out and you're transported. It's one of the first virtual reality experiences that anyone ever encounters in your life. So for me, it was a first visit to my local planetarium, the Hayden Planetarium in New York.
The very one that you direct.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it reads better in a small town than in New York. In New York, no one cares. But yeah, if it was a small town, Native Son comes back to direct the planetarium that
you didn't get those headlines, huh? You didn't get
that. Yeah, the New York Times did not write about that fact.
So you went to the planetarium, and the lights went out, and your jaw dropped, and you thought, wow.
Yeah, the universe just sort of called me. I feel like I really had no say in the matter. And it started coursing through my circulatory system. And I said, that's what I'm going to be. That was at age 9. And by 11, I figured out that actually you can make a career out of it. And that's when, if you were an adult asking that annoying question of children, which is,
what do you want to be when you grow up?
And I would reply, an astrophysicist, which usually just stopped the conversation.
I bet it did. Did you have a, well, New York's not a great place for stargazing from your apartment window, but did you have a telescope?
Yeah, so my first telescope was a gift from my parents. It was one of these sort of, you know, floor model, inexpensive telescopes. And within a year, I realized, of course, that I needed a better one. And I grew up in New York City in an apartment building, mm-hmm. and I was able to make money by walking other people's dogs at 50 cents per dog per walk. Now I didn't know it at the time, but I had it really good because I didn't have to clean up after them. The pooper scooper laws were not yet in effect. So I made enough money to buy a larger telescope and a camera, and that was by the time I was in middle school, so that when I was in high school, I was total astro geek.
And you were doing this, you grew up about the same time as me, and this was the time of the space race and the birth of, I mean, all of this is about 50 years old. It's not much older than we've been exploring space. And I was thinking back, preparing to talk to you, about the way we imagined what was in the stars and planets, and it seems, just in retrospect, that it's pretty different than the sort of blasé acceptance that we have right now.
Well, all right, so I have a yes. However, what I remember more about that period is what we all imagined the future would be. You know, think about it. You're going to the moon. There is technology writ large, the fruits of technology and science writ large in the daily newspapers. And you have people thinking about tomorrow in big ways. Mm-hmm. Cover stories of Life magazine and Time magazine and Look magazine and Collier's magazine talking about the city of tomorrow and the home of tomorrow, transportation of tomorrow. That's an attitude that mm-hmm. prevailed, and it continued to the early 70s, and then it just stopped. And it stopped coincident with the last mission to the moon. So I would claim that when you're doing things such as that, it infuses an entire other attitude in your society where you want to make tomorrow come too. And you know that it's science and technology that will enable it. And so you begin to embrace science and technology, and you want to become one of these technologists. And if you're not, you'll go to a field that will serve it. For example, you want to become a lawyer, maybe you become a space lawyer. Who owns those minerals on that asteroid? So everybody becomes a participant in this epic adventure.
What I remember from 1969, I believe it was, wasn't that the first walk on the moon, 1969?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What I remember, because it was a far simpler time, we hadn't gotten to the future of the internet at that point, was people gathering around a television set to watch it. It was something that was an event. Every time a rocket was launched from, and it changed names from Cape Canaveral to Cape Kennedy, I think it's Cape Canaveral again, it was a civic event. And in a way that, after Challenger exploded, obviously that was a civic event, but it just seems like, because it was new, maybe because of the reasons that you state, it brought us together more as a nation.
Well, so yeah, I have two reactions to that. So first, yes, it was Cape Canaveral, then it was Cape Kennedy, then they opened Kennedy Space Center, so that got the Kennedy name preserved, and then it went back to Cape Canaveral. So that's the tracking as I remember it. About everyone crowding, hovering, clustering around the 12-inch black and white
black
televisions
and white.
of the day. Yeah, you tell this to anyone today, they say, what? and the cavemen were next door. How old are you?
Right.
What is this?
We beat on the tom-toms to say the rocket has launched. But you do remember that, right?
Yeah, exactly. And just one other quick thing. I was in L.A. just yesterday, and I was on the Walk with the Stars, you know, mm-hmm. I guess it's Hollywood Boulevard, and you know, they have icons of where you were and how you entertained people. So if there's a radio, there's an icon of a radio. And if you're TV, there's a little TV. And it's just a square with two rabbit ear antennas sticking out. And I'm thinking, nobody knows what those are.
No, they don't. It's,
that is not a symbol of a television ever again, you know. To your point, yes, people hovered around. And it was, I loved your phrasing, it was a civic moment because it was something that had never been done before. And exploring space, exploring anything that's never been done before has always been a civic moment. Well, you know, when Columbus returned from his voyages, he regaled people of his stories and brought riches to the queen, Queen Isabella, and King Ferdinand. Anytime you explore and do what no one has done, go and do what no one has been or done before, you are honored in society and statues are built to you. Space is that next frontier. So if you only ever do the same thing as astronauts did before, you can't expect people to hover around the television. And the shuttle era space exploration wasn't really exploration. It was you were driving around the block and boldly going where hundreds had gone before. So I submit to you that if you had the first astronauts to walk on Mars, that would be another civic moment and the world would stop to watch that happen.
Neil deGrasse Tyson is with us. As you're speaking, I'm thinking about how the engineering, the minds of engineers, are not focused on space. They're focused on nanotechnology. They're focused on all the gadgetry that we now use to replace those rabbit ears and black and white televisions, you know, phones that do that, which does capture a lot of people's imaginations, but in proportion to the infinity of the universe, the infinity of nanotechnology, it's like making something infinitely smaller as opposed to expanding it infinitely larger.
Well, plus everybody's been abusing the prefix nano. Nano means 1 billionth.
Billion.
And every nano person I've spoken to are not making anything that's 1 billionth the size of anything. All right? If there's a little robot that fits in the palm of your hand, they call it a nanobot. Yeah, it's 1 billionth of what? Excuse me? You know, it's just a little robot, please. Nano. So many people have taken the word just to reference small things. On the subject of small things, parents had radios as furniture in their living rooms. At the time, nobody was thinking, I want to carry that on my hip pocket. You know who started the movement of miniaturizing electronics?
It was NASA. Of course.
That's right. Because it cost more money to lift a heavy thing than a light thing. So any possible electronics that could be miniaturized was done so. And that then people realized, yes, I might want to carry a radio in my hip pocket. And thus was born that entire movement of portable consumer electronics.
I know that George W. Bush appointed you as a NASA advisor. That was an official appointment. You were interested in the agency long before that, I assume. What has changed over the scope of several presidential terms when we talk about the federal attitude towards space program?
Yeah, that's a brilliant question, and the real full answer is subtle and complex. But let me sort of give a broad stroke answer. Not since the 1970s have we left low Earth orbit, period. And low Earth orbit is a couple of hundred miles up. That's where the space station orbits and the space shuttles have ever been. And so space got redefined after Apollo to mean just going into orbit. Oh, Russia's going to make a space station. We better have one too. Oh, now how are we going to build it? We're going to have a shuttle. All right. And so, yes, these are engineering marvels, but they're not really extending a space frontier. And so President George W. Bush in the early 2004 vowed to get us back out of low Earth orbit onto Moon, Mars and beyond. And so I was on a commission to establish the most efficient tracking to do that within the limited budget. Obama comes in and says, well, you know, we've been to the moon. Let's just go to Mars and skip the moon. Meanwhile, there's a whole set of people who were tasked for getting us back to the moon who had jobs related to that. They all got laid off. So a simple sentence from the Obama administration, let's leapfrog the moon, go to Mars, which sounds very forward-thinking, ended up crippling whole communities of the NASA family. It was an interesting consequence to trying to think forward into the future. But on top of that, I'm sorry, I'm blathering.
No, go ahead.
But on top of, you got me, you started this.
I okay? know, I did.
On top of that, the current plan is we might get to Mars by the late 2020s or the 2030s. And I'm thinking, okay, this is a current president saying what we're going to do in 20 years. And, well, he's not going to be president. So this is under the watch of a president to be named later on a budget not yet established. That's not promising a future. That's like, you know what that would be like? That would be like Kennedy in 1961 says, we'll put a man on the moon and return him safely to the earth before the century is out. if that's how you're going to introduce policies, nothing will ever get done. So you got to have some resolve. And by the way, it costs more to do it in less time. Money and time are sort of inverse functions of one another in these kinds of projects. So the more money you have, the less time it will take, typically. So I would have preferred Obama said, in my administration, that this will happen and we'll have a first whatever to Mars, and even if more journeys occur after.
Have you met with him to talk about
this? Yes, I have. We're not beer drinking buddies, but I've met him a few times.
and have you expressed to him that that was a big mistake, Mr. President?
No. I don't do that. That's not what I do. I don't tell politicians anything unless they explicitly ask me, because they're duly elected by an electorate. And as an educator, my task should be to educate the electorate, so that if they then want to go into space, they'll be informed about how to think that way, and they can make it incumbent upon their elected officials to do so. So, yes, I've testified to Congress several times, but not by my own initiative. They called me because they needed some expert testimony about one thing or another. It's all space related. But I'm just saying I don't like talking to politicians, which is like the opposite of what a lobbyist does,
right?
Of course. But it's a personal philosophy of mine.
What role does the private sector now play in space exploration?
Well, first, the private sector has always been there. This is something that the press has not picked up on. The private sector has been together with NASA from the beginning. From 1958 onward, there are key components of what it is to explore space that were supplied by the aerospace industry. Back then, it was like the aeronautics industry,
right,
which then would become a space industry, aerospace industry. Mm-hmm. And that would include companies like Boeing and Lockheed Martin, and which was once Lockheed and Martin Marietta,
right.
Marietta, and Grumman, this sort of thing. And so consider that the LEM, the Lunar Excursion Module, was built and designed in Bethpage, Long Island, New York. And to this day, people walk those streets with pride that their cousin, their parents, or had a hand in creating the contents of the Saturn V rocket, which enabled humans to walk on the moon. So, and that was Grumman. That was a Grumman factory. So NASA's been with private enterprise forever. The difference is, what SpaceX has done is SpaceX is like doing some of NASA's travel for him,
right,
for it. So NASA can't get cargo to the space station. By the way, we are still caretakers of the space station, but we don't have our own vehicle to do it. We're hitching a ride on the Russian Soyuz capsule. Actually, we're not hitching. We're paying for those seats, and
like
it only holds
like
three
a commercial people. Airplane ticket.
Exactly, and it doesn't hold much cargo either. $25 per bag. So there's no cargo. So how do you get food and supplies to the space station? Was not a problem when you had the shuttle. Shuttle had a whole payload bay, and shuttle was like luxurious compared to the Soyuz. Soyuz is a capsule with your knees are up in your chin. I've sat in one. I'm a little big for it. But the point is, so SpaceX is delivering cargo to the space station. That should have been happening decades ago. Get NASA out of the go-to-low-Earth orbit business and put it back on the frontier where it belongs.
What you told me you testified to Congress. You're not really interested in lobbying, but I'm assuming that there are members of Congress who perhaps are as excited as you are about some of these big ideas, yes?
Yes, but here's the challenge. Everyone knows we're in a fiscal issues, fiscal problems
yes,
going on.
Yes, we are.
And so the typical response is, well, we can't afford to go to space right now. Let's save that for when we have money. That presumes that this is just some luxury activity conducted by scientists and engineers, and you can take it or leave it. That's what that whole reaction assumes that, right? It's built into the construct of that comment. And we'll consider a couple of things. First, when we went to the moon, we were in a cold war with Russia, a hot war in Southeast Asia with 100 servicemen per week dying. There was the peak of the civil rights movement. There was campus unrest. There were assassinations. And we went to the moon. Mm-hmm. So don't tell me we somehow have a unique set of portfolio of problems that we can't afford to do this, first of all. Just first. But more important than that, what's really going on is if you go into space in a big way and you advance a frontier, you have to innovate to do that. Patents are awarded. Discoveries are made. Headlines are written. And I'm in school. I'm an eighth grader. I read these headlines. It's like, whoa, they just figured out a way to extract water from the poles of the moon where the sun don't shine. They figured out how to mine an asteroid and bring back platinum and gold. And that's cool. Oh, they just figured out a way to navigate the rarefied atmosphere of Mars with an airplane on Mars. That's cool. The biologists just found life on Mars, microbial. That's cool. So everybody now wants to become a scientist or an engineer. Just because they see how cool that is. That NASA, as an agency, should be renamed the Department of Inspiration.
I like that. You've been given a title, I'm not sure if it was official, America's preeminent badass astrophysicist. And
I had nothing to do with
that. I'm starting to understand why that is. And then I can't name any other astrophysicists aside from Carl Sagan. And I know, and if it hasn't happened, it's imminent that you're going to reincarnate Cosmos.
Yes, in fact, it was not imminent, but we're in the middle of it now. And it should air, we're expecting to air it 13 episodes beginning spring 2014,
so a
year from now.
And that was one of the things that did help ignite that science and engineering imagination. I mean, I think
yes,
that was...
Yes, it did. Exactly, because what the effect it had was, it wasn't just science to learn about it. It was science as something that's fundamental to what it is to be alive and why you should care about it as an informed citizen of your country, the planet, a citizen of the universe. So it was science that reached people on an almost spiritual level. Spiritual with a lowercase s. Not that spirits danced in and around you. So in this 21st century incarnation of that series, we are remembering all the ways that series affected people. And we're taking it into the 21st century. And I'm host, and Andrewian is one of the original writers. And the principles of the original, and she's doing that again now. And so, probably the biggest news there was that Seth MacFarlane is one of our executive producers, the creator of Family Guy. So people got a little freaky about that. They're worried that maybe Stewie would pop up and rear his head, his football-shaped head.
But no.
No. He was our sort of, he brought this whole project to Fox. It's going to appear on Fox in a year.
So essentially, our whole conversation, which we're about to end, unfortunately, because it's been great talking to you about this, is that
you call me to talk about the universe and we're only doing it for 20 minutes.
Yeah, I'm not in charge of the schedule. There's these guys in the other room that you know point to their watches. But
okay.
But it's about imagination. It's about reigniting a quest. That is your goal.
Yes, and back in the day, it was of course ignited by war. I mean, we're at war with the Soviet Union. And so that's what drove it initially. But the consequence to it was that everybody wanted to invent a new future. And that's, with that kind of thinking and that kind of training of your population, that's what creates the economies of tomorrow, innovations in science and technology. So I would say go to space so that your nation can become wealthy. Other countries certainly know this. That I say that, I offer that just in case you don't care about discovery. Or what Saturn's rings looks like. I'm okay with. I'm not going to twist your arm. I happen to think it's amazing stuff, but I won't force you to want that. But in this, a capitalist democracy, nobody wants to die poor, and we don't want to recede on the world stage because our economy is tanking. So people need to think of the space program as an investment in our economic strength, not simply as an activity of eggheads.
Well, you've inspired me. I'm ready to go bravely where no middle-aged woman has gone before me. Okay. Thanks so much for taking time, and take care in the snow that is yet to come in New York City.
Yes, thank you for the bidding of that. Thanks.
Neil deGrasse Tyson directs the Hayden Planetarium at New York's American Museum of Natural History. His latest book, Space Chronicles, has been released in paperback. This is 94.9 KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.
/9:49, a look at the ongoing issue of PTSD diagnoses and the Department of Defense in a minute.
And one of the critiques of the Occupy movement from, you know, all the courtiers on the airwaves was, what are their demands? They don't have any demands. Well, they had a very clear demand, and that is, we want to reverse the corporate coup d'etat and take back for the citizenry the power that has been wrested from our hands by corporations. But that was, of course, a message that Wall Street and its minions could never hear.
Journalist and book author Chris Hedges with a talk called Corporate Coup d'Etat, tonight at 8 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the City of Seattle, working to stem pollution in the Lower Duwamish Waterway by offering tips and tools such as how to dispose of hazardous materials, prevent spills, and stencil storm drains. More information online at seattle.gov by searching Protect Duwamish.
Turning back to the sky for a moment, it's mostly cloudy over Seattle, 45 degrees. Forecast says expect showers through the day with an afternoon high of 48. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:51. It looks like the sequester budget cuts will mean longer lines at the U.S.-Canada border. That and more news from Canada in 15 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Steve shares off this week. You may recall the brouhaha last year around Madigan Army Medical Center and how military hospitals and medical centers diagnose cases of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, in soldiers. Senator Patty Murray asked for an investigation into the situation at Madigan, and the Army followed with a more broad Army-wide investigation. Joining us now to talk more about official military attitudes towards the diagnosis and treatment of PTSD is our own KUOW, Patricia Murphy, who covers the military for us. And I want to really take a couple steps back from Madigan to have you define officially post-traumatic stress disorder.
Sure. Post-traumatic stress disorder is a type of anxiety disorder, and it is a natural reaction to a traumatic event. It can occur after you've seen or experienced trauma, or perhaps you have felt threatened by a traumatic event. Someone within your proximity is in danger, and it can occur with any trauma. PTSD can trigger a physiological reaction, or flight or fight response. Sometimes that person will relive the event. You will be hypervigilant sometimes. You know, you'll sit down and you'll have to take in everything in a room. You'll have to plan out your exits, disaster scenarios going through your head.
So it can manifest in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And very individual to the person who experienced the trauma.
Which would make a diagnosis probably difficult.
Like most, yes. Yes, very difficult.
So remind us why Senator Murray pushed for a study of Madigan and then military-wide.
Well, Patty Murray heads the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, and she called for an investigation into the situation at Madigan Army Medical Center because at the time it was brought to light that they were using a so-called forensic psychiatry team to review PTSD diagnoses of soldiers who in some cases were going through the medical retirement process. And now a forensic psychiatry person, a forensic psychiatrist, is someone who is usually used in a courtroom scenario to ferret out liars.
Oh.
To, you know, verify or deny someone's testimony. So it's particularly important to those soldiers who are going through the medical retirement because it could potentially affect their disability benefits. And in some cases, it was true, those PTSD diagnoses were either reversed or lessened to other anxiety disorders.
And that...
So once that investigation was opened, into Madigan, Senator Murray pushed for an army-wide investigation as well, which Leon Panetta ordered. And they reviewed PTSD treatments dating back to 2001. And what we know now is that review resulted in 24 findings and 47 recommendations. And we were supposed to learn about those this morning during a briefing from the Pentagon, but they canceled it due to weather in Washington, D.C.
Oh, that's right. It is supposed to snow. It is snowing. So why were the soldiers who had been diagnosed initially with PTSD at Madigan downgraded, specifically those cases? Do we know?
We don't know. And we don't know officially. And we may never know because the Department of Defense MedCom has denied our FOIA requests and our appeals to release the results of those three separate investigations at Madigan. We are out of appeals that we would not have to take to court at this point.
Well, you talk to a lot of soldiers in your work at Joint Base Lewis-McChord, and I'm assuming some of them were the downgraded soldiers. What specifically do they want from either the Army or the federal government when it comes to benefits or diagnoses?
It's kind of a tricky question. Because a lot of soldiers who may be dealing with post-traumatic stress don't come forward. And a lot of that is – it's for a variety of reasons. Some of that is the warrior ethos, and some just don't want to talk about what they're experiencing. And the military has made great efforts to try to get people to understand that it's okay to come forward. Mm-hmm. But in some cases – they're just not comfortable doing that. And that's something that the Army deals with every day as well. In some cases, soldiers have told me they're dissatisfied with the level of care they have gotten. And sometimes it's about access to care. It's really important, and I just want to point it out, that there are many resources for veterans and soldiers outside of the military. There are many civilian therapists who are doing this work pro bono, and Soldiers Project Northwest is one of them, but there are many.
So if they want care and there's not necessarily benefits forthcoming, they probably can find
that. Or if they don't feel comfortable going through the medical system in the military, there are people outside.
How widespread is PTSD among vets?
Well, the VA estimates that about 10% of Gulf War veterans have experienced post-traumatic stress. The rate is higher for vets from Iraq and Afghanistan. We don't have definitive numbers right now. It's about 13%, the VA national is saying, but you just don't know.
So back to this report about which the briefing was canceled because of snow. Do you have any hint what we might hear?
I think anyone who's listened to soldiers and followed this story for a while can speculate that we will hear about things like access to care and quality of care, perhaps in the worst case, retaliation for seeking care. And that last one is a big one if it's substantiated, because PTSD with appropriate care is 100% treatable. You can get your life back. It may be a different life, but it will be a quality of life that you can return to, which is good. And it would be truly sad, I think, in some cases if soldiers were re-traumatized for seeking help for what is essentially a normal reaction to an intense situation.
I know you'll be following it when and if they reconvene their press conference. Patricia Murphy covers the military for KUOW. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
And now, the sound of the day.
Is it a wind-up toy? Oh, no. It's the sound of frogs singing in a pond in Kingston, and that's a sure sign that spring is fast approaching. Listener Kurt sent those frogs to us. Let's listen to them again. I like the idea. Spring's approaching, froggies. What interesting sounds are you listening to? We'd love for you to record 30 seconds and send them to us along with the story behind your sound. You can email that to weekday@kuow.org and be sure to include sound of the day in your subject line. It's very sweet, isn't it? The sound of spring here on KUOW. Coming up in the next hour of Weekday, we travel north as we do on Wednesday to talk with Vaughn Palmer. He's even further north than usual. I believe he's in Kamloops. And we're going to talk about the impact the sequester is having north of the border. It doesn't just affect us. Oh, no, it is global. We're also going to talk to Robert Horton, who's back from vacation, and he's going to give us the sort of armchair quarterbacking on the Academy Awards, winners, losers, hosts, production, all of it, and a little bit about what's playing in theaters these days. And last but certainly not least, how the sequester has impacted Wall Street. You know, it hit a record yesterday. What did that mean for our local Northwest companies? Michelle Matassa Flores of Puget Sound Business Journal will be in. It's all coming up in the next hour on Weekday here on 94.9 KUOW. Stay with us.
It's 9:59. There's news out this morning that the private sector added nearly 200,000 jobs in February. More about that in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Legacy Recordings, presenting People, Hell, and Angels, the new Jimi Hendrix studio album featuring 12 previously unreleased studio recordings, including Somewhere and Hear My Train A-Comin'. Available now.
The last time your boss told you you were doing a good job, he wasn't.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.